This is Let's Keep It Real with Sandy Joy Weston, your weekly dose of positivity with awesome stories and guests from all over the world. It's an opportunity to learn some great new things and expand your mind. We'll tackle topics from all areas of life, and as always with Sandy, the sky's the limit.
My Let's Keep It Real people. I think I told you about this, about Mark coming on, Mark Graban. I was on his show. He made me think about mistakes. And I was like, wait a minute. You sure I made some? Only kidding. Anyhow, before I bring Mark in, let me just tell you a little bit about him. He's an internationally recognized consultant, published author, professional speaker, blogger, podcaster, which is how I met him, and entrepreneur. He builds upon a deep education in engineering and management with practical experience. By the way, I didn't even know some of this, working with executives and frontline employees in multiple industry. He synthesizes and practices approaches, including lean management, continuous improvement, statistical methods, and people-centered leadership cultivate psychological safety and employee engagement. Mark helps others learn how to improve and sustain performance. Mark, I'm so glad you're on my show.
Yay! I'm so happy to be here. Hearing that term and knowing a little bit about your background, lean management sounds like a fitness or a wellness program, but it's not.
I know. We'll get into it. All right, but before we do, what's one word that pops in your head? Whatever word that pops in your head that describes your past 30 days, and then why'd you pick it?
One word. Okay. It's got pop into my head.
It's whatever it is, good, bad, or ugly.
Okay. So I would say building.
Building.
I don't know why that. Now I got to think about, why did that word pop into my head? Because I've been working, I don't mean a building, but I, you know, at the beginning of the year, the way cycles go, you know, busy times, you know, with other work, January, you know, December tends to be a month of reflection. January tends to be a month of building. So I've been working with some people. I'm building a couple of online courses. I'm trying to build some other capabilities that'll help me keep building my business. So it's a time, you know, a month to try investing in myself, if you will.
Okay. So while you're doing this, the people want to know, how do you not, let's back up a second. Mm-hmm. How do you keep yourself grounded if you're mostly working from home and still stay connected to others? And does it work for you? So I got a lot of questions about that. First of all, do you work mostly from home?
It depends on the month. I mean, there's some work from home. Like when I'm not working with clients or doing things with people on site, I'm working from home, a lot of time on Zoom, a lot of times on Teams. These systems are always grabbing the wrong microphone. I have a nice external microphone here and I'm always like, yeah, they can't hear me.
Yeah.
Wrong microphone. You think I would have figured that out by now. But I try to stay connected. I'm not trying to be a think tank here, you know, with my writing and podcasting. So I stay connected with people, through the work I'm doing with them, coaching or consulting, or even if I go do a speaking engagement, that's not just showing up and giving a canned spiel. You know, I'm talking to leaders at the organization and really trying to understand their situation, their challenges, so I can tailor what I'm going to be sharing, you know, to that situation. So I think that keeps me grounded, but you're right. There's always a risk of, if I was always at home, never working with people, and then, writing books about leadership, people might say, well, where's that coming from?
All right. Well, I have a personal question. Do you feel connected as much? Like some of my friends say they feel just as connected on Zoom as if they saw me in person. Do you feel that?
No, not as connected. Now, I mean, you're very engaging through Zoom. I've never met you in person. That would probably be better. You know, I mean, I think there's still no substitute for meeting, doing things in person opportunity, given the chance. Now, I think one thing we learned in the pandemic is we can do more virtually than we might have thought possible in the past. But I'm still a big fan of, I'd rather do an in-person speaking engagement than a virtual Engagement? Oh my goodness. I just made a mistake. Can I tell you about this?
No, you made a mistake. Let's highlight it. No, tell us what happened.
Okay.
We did not plan this, everybody.
All right. It was a matter of time before this happened, and we captured it on camera, I think.
Yay!
We could go back and review the game notes. So I spilled water on myself. Thankfully, it wasn't hot tea, which it looks like you might be drinking. So you see this coffee mug with the broken handle?
Yes.
So this is a my favorite mistake coffee mug. And the first time I had ordered these from a vendor online, I think I'd ordered 10 mugs. And at least half of them arrived broken. Broken.
Oh, they arrived like that.
They arrived broken. And I might need to stop and go grab a towel real quick.
I want you to go stop and grab a towel because they're going to think I planned this and I did
it. I'll be right back.
You go do it. All right. So just so you know, when I was on Mark's podcast, The Mistakes That Make Us, I didn't know how to take that because I was thinking, I always trained my brain to say, okay, it didn't work out that time. Now what can I do? But after talking to Mark for a while, I realized I was learning from my mistakes. I just wasn't devastated by them. I was like, okay, there's always a solution. There's always a way out. And there's always a learning experience. I just was naming it something different. Yeah. I think we talked about that.
Yes,
it was hard for me to say. And not that I don't screw stuff up because I'm like, I can't believe I did that or said that or,
yeah.
or how did I not make, sign that paper? You know,
I make mistakes all the time. I wish I didn't, but I try to be more honest about them and acknowledge them. This is one I'm going to laugh about, right? So let me tell the rest of the story here with the mug. And thankfully, didn't spill water on my keyboard.
I was just worried about that.
Yeah, I didn't do that. But so, you know, these mugs were broken. And I emailed the company. I'm like, okay, we'll replace the broken mugs. And so they sent more. A couple of those were broken in the replacement order. So I've got these, you know, mugs. I'm like, oh, I'm going to throw them away or what do I do? But this is Japanese art. And I'm going to blank out on the name. But there's a Japanese term for taking like a broken bowl, or in this case, a broken mug, and you glue it together with like, you know, kind of a gold shimmery.
Yeah.
Powder and glue, and to make it more beautiful than it was before. And, you know, I think that that's so fitting with the theme of learning from mistakes. And if we can learn from mistakes, we're going to be better off maybe than we would be if we hadn't made the mistake, or we'll be better off by learning from it instead of being in denial or blaming others.
Absolutely.
So these mugs with their glued on handles, I'm going to learn from this though. They have been really solid. Now, maybe my mistake is putting them through the dishwasher.
Ooh, don't do that.
And then maybe over, that was admittedly a mistake. And then, you know, I guess it was just a matter of time then before it broke. So lessons learned, I'm not going to put these mugs in the dishwasher. I'm not going to use them with hot liquids because thankfully I have plenty of mugs without broken handles.
Yeah.
That could have been a lot worse, but I mostly spilled water because this is work from home. I, even though it's wintertime, I'm wearing shorts instead of, and I,
like I'm wearing sweats with my suit.
I spilled water on my shorts. So I'll be mildly uncomfortable here as a reminder of my mistake. I'm happy I could share that with you, Sandy.
I'm so glad. And guess what? You know, you get a chance to rebuild that mug again because you're going to be able to golden glue it if you want. Again,
yeah, I think different. that one's going to become like a pen holder, kind of like this other broken handled mug became. So,
or trash. All right. So now, and I mean this in the most honest way, I can talk about anything. Do you want to go change?
No, I'm okay.
You sure? Because we can
sure.
We can cut, we can change, we can do whatever we want. All right.
I'm fine. I have derailed your show enough.
No, no, you actually made it better. You were, I mean, just talking about it. And then I was just talking earlier about, you know, don't do things just to prove your point. And people can see through it. It's so manipulative, you know. I feel manipulated, but this was authentic, so you can't explain that stuff, you know.
Yeah. So, I looked up the Japanese word. It's kintsugi. So we've maybe kintsugied your episode.
Yeah, and I've seen that before because my son's in art school and he loves Japanese culture, but I couldn't remember the name of it either. Yeah. All right, so I'll be able to tell him that we did that.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to back up a little bit because I got a lot of questions over and over again. I always make up people's names, Sally Bell and Billy Bell. Uh-huh. They ask over and over and over again, which I thought, wait, this is hysterical. Not about them, about somebody they know who are well-meaning good people, but can't admit they make a mistake.
Mm.
And how? And I got it from employers.
Mm-hmm.
I got it from spouses.
Yeah.
And I got it from parents.
Yeah.
And a lot.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get someone who can't say, and a lot of times, you know, there's a big thing in don't say you're sorry that much. But we're talking about bosses, coworkers, the whole gamut, your kids. It's almost as if I'm hearing, if I don't want to put words in all of their mouth, because it was a lot of people asking the same question in a way. If you make a mistake, it's like an insult on you. Like you're not a good person, or what did one person says? It's almost like they think nobody's going to like them. And it's a character flaw. Mm. I think it's a character flaw the other way.
I understand. I mean, look, there's a lot of emotion. I can understand the emotion of even what we just put upon ourselves or what we say to ourselves when we make a mistake. Like people may think things that are kind of self-shaming about a mistake. And that could come from, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a marriage counselor. I'm not a parent.
Yeah.
I am married. And I think about these things more like in the workplace context. But my take on it, just my own thoughts and experiences is, you know, the way people think about their own mistakes, let's just start there for a minute. Mm-hmm. You know, that could be a function. It's not a function of character. You know, I think a lot of it is upbringing. How did your parents react to mistakes? How were you, you know, treated in school when you got a wrong answer or made a mistake or playing sports?
Yep.
Or in the workplace, there's a lot of unhelpful reactions to mistakes of people getting upset, blaming you for something that wasn't really your fault.
All the time.
And then I think people internalize that and they might think, well, what's wrong with me or shame on me? And, you know, I don't like the phrase, for example, if someone says, oh, well, that was a stupid mistake. Well, smart people make mistakes. Like if you make a mistake, it's really more about a lot of times being human, you know, making a bad assumption. Like I made a bad assumption that the handle on this mug was going to hold. You're going to make more mistakes when you're fatigued or when you get distracted. You know, so there's a lot of factors that help lead to mistakes. A lot of workplaces don't set people up for success in terms of how the work is designed. But, you know, to answer the other part of the question, you know, I think, you know, if you're a leader, if you're a manager, if you're a business owner, what I've learned about some of the psychology behind this is, you know, leaders really need to do two things. One is basically being willing to admit their own mistakes, right? Now, a business owner, you know, if they're the boss, like they can't get fired by anybody for admitting a mistake. They might be putting less at risk by leading the way, but depending on what's going on in their head, they may feel like, as you were saying, they may feel a sense of shame. They might think people will respect them less when actually the opposite is true. Like people respect the vulnerability, the authenticity. Like, you know, if a leader thinks their employees think they're perfect, they're probably wrong. Like your employees know you're not perfect. So I think just acknowledging a mistake is healthy personally. I think it's helpful then in a workplace. So the first thing a leader needs to do is lead by example and admit their own mistakes, or to say, I was wrong, or even I could be wrong. So let's go test this idea before we spend a ton of money on the marketing campaign. Let's do a small test. And then the second thing leaders need to do is rewarding others for speaking up in that same way. And I know it might sound weird to say, you're going to reward people for making a mistake. I'm not saying write them a big check, but I'm saying something beyond don't punish people. When we punish people for mistakes, all that does is teach people to try to drive the mistakes underground.
Yeah.
And then none of us can improve. None of us can get better. So, I mean, if people don't like the word rewarding mistakes, I mean, you could say things like acknowledge the mistakes and react to them in a way that's constructive. And then I think over time, you can build people's comfort or you know, people use the phrase psychological safety. You know, instead of telling somebody you should speak up, it's your job. You good people speak up. People with, you know, high character admit mistakes. Well, no. You know, people will admit mistakes when they feel like it's safe to do so, and when they think something positive will result from admitting the mistake. So leaders can really kind of cultivate the conditions where people feel safe to speak up, even if they feel a sense of shame internally. You know, we can try to look through that.
I was thinking about that after I was on your podcast, because somebody asked me, did you have a lot of turnover with your health clubs? And Mark, we didn't. I mean, we're very fortunate. I was in business 30 something. I didn't have that much turnover. But people would come in all the time and say they made a mistake. And I would say, well, you won't do that again. Now, what'd you learn? And how can I help?
Right.
And after your show, I mean, I never even thought about that until after your show. I thought maybe that was one of the biggest reasons people stayed. I mean, they felt comfortable, you know? I even remember my business partner, who was with me for years, came in when he was still my general manager. And he goes, oh my God, I made a mistake on our taxes and I just cost you $10,000. And that was a lot of money to me. And I was like, okay. Is there any way we can recoup? He goes, I don't think so. Okay. So what did you learn? Not to do the taxes myself and hire an accountant, right?
Right.
But it endeared me to him.
Yeah.
And ended up more so because he was honest about it. And we moved through. And that took a lot of courage. And he ended up being my business partner. I made him my business partner. Because I thought that took guts. And he didn't try to blame somebody else or somebody filed. Or they made him. Like, there's a million ways he could have covered that up. He could have covered it up so many ways.
But that question... And I think this is such a good habit. I was so happy to hear you say it. Asking, what did you learn? That's so powerful. And a reaction that says, I mean, I think it's in the tone and then the follow-up. But if you or somebody says, yeah, I'm sure you're not going to do that again. That might kind of sound like a threat or a warning.
Okay. Well, that won't happen again.
Right. But the question is how, right? So there may be some short-term effect. If somebody makes a mistake that's like a mental lapse or something, we'll be aware of it for a little while, and you're probably less likely to do it again in the short term, but then that fades, right? So part of the, I think, a constructive reaction to a mistake is digging into that question of what do we learn? Like, instead of saying, who messed up, we can ask questions that start with different words, like, well, how did that happen? What allowed that to happen? Now we start thinking about how do we prevent that mistake from happening again in ways that are more effective than telling people, hey, be careful.
Yeah. And I love this word. I haven't heard it till recently, but I want your explanation of this, because I do really believe, oh man, you can walk into a business and you can tell the culture. And if people are happy and, like you say, feeling of security, psychological safety. Tell me a little bit more about that, because you gave me the statement, to cultivate that culture in a workplace, leaders need to foster a feeling of psychological safety to help people feel safe speaking up. I want to know more about what you consider psychological safety.
So there's different researchers and academics out there with different definitions of psychological safety, different words to the same concept. So, you know, I kind of synthesize some of those different definitions. Psychological safety basically is a feeling, or you could say a belief or a perception, that when I speak up, it's going to be rewarded instead of being punished. And, you know, punishment could mean getting fired, getting yelled at. It could mean being kind of marginalized and being kind of outcast like that, you know, being ignored. But, you know, feeling safe to speak up about things, including but not limited to pointing out problems, admitting mistakes, asking questions, suggesting a better way of doing things. Like the workplaces where those different actions, not just admitting mistakes, but you know, I'm passionate about continuous improvement. If people speak up, I've seen and heard stories from people, they're new to a job, they're new to a company. Let's say a nurse, you know, I do a lot of work in healthcare, a nurse who's worked at other hospitals, brand new to a hospital, they bring a lot of experiences with them. And let's say they bring up an idea around, you know, organizing the medication cart or the supply room or something. Like they're being well-intended of like, well, things could be better. I want to share something that we did in another workplace. And people might get shut down, you know, with things like, well, hey, you're new here. Or, you know, you don't understand how we do things. Or, you know, when that proves to be unwelcome, people learn pretty quickly. Like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm not really getting in trouble, but it's just not leading to anything. If it's not a fear factor kicking in, it's what you could call the futility factor, right? So psychological safety is an important first step to help people feel safe to speak up, but then we need to do something with what people are saying. Otherwise they'll stop, you know? So it's really a lot about just the environment or the culture or the conditions that people are working in.
You know, I was thinking what you said before about a leader, and they have the best opportunity to be vulnerable and admit they make mistakes because they're not going to lose their jobs. But I never even thought about what of all the other people? Maybe they don't speak up because you said, like you said, the culture, they don't feel safe and they could really lose their jobs and they can't afford to lose their jobs.
Right. Right. And that's where I touch on this in the book, like as much as I want people to be in an environment where they can speak up, because I think most people want to speak up. They want to contribute to the organization. They want to be able to ask questions that help themselves do a better job. But as I touched on in the book, I'm not going to say you should speak up because it's so situational.
Yeah,
I don't want someone to read my book and say, well, it probably wouldn't happen, but and I spilled water on this book now. I'm discovering too. The water went everywhere. Mark Graven says, you should speak up at work. And then they speak up and get fired. Well, I don't want
someone
angry at me or suing me. Or I try to make that point very clearly. Like it's natural and understandable, you know, that people are going to protect themselves and protect their paychecks. And I see this in healthcare where there are such power dynamics. Mm. And hierarchies of, you know, nurses being lower in the professional pecking order than the doctors or surgeons. And there's so many cases where nurses get bullied into keeping quiet. And then surgeon makes a mistake, patient gets harmed. Could have been avoided if the nurse felt safe to speak up. And the surgeon has to welcome that as one of the leaders in that situation. But then I never like it when, you know, sometimes I hear people kind of lecturing nurses like, well, you should speak up and it's your professional obligation and oaths and all of this. And I'm nonsense. You know, think of, you know, the nurse, I'm just going to pick a scenario, you know, the nurse who's a single mother and kind of living paycheck to paycheck. And like, you expect that nurse to put her home and her family's home on the line? When speaking up is a choice, like, I think that's unfair. And I would understand why people protect themselves. They probably don't feel good about not speaking up.
Yeah.
You know, think about the toll that takes on people. And that's why I think there's such an obligation. Like, if we want to be a high performing organization, the variable that really helps indicate that is the level of psychological safety. So I mean, we could think about, back to your business, Sandy. If turnover was low, one of the factors there probably is a high degree of psychological safety. That tends to correlate. When people feel that safety,
they don't want to leave.
And when people feel psychological safety, they end up actually, like, if you're being constructive about the mistakes that are happening, you're learning from them, you're improving, people feel good about that. They're making fewer mistakes over time because we have this kind of learning and improvement response to them. That helps drive business success.
Yeah.
I can see those connections.
To me, it just made, I mean, I never thought of these things. Mm-hmm. It was just how you treat people. It was just, to me, common sense. Like,
But
even if you were thinking just about the almighty dollar, it still makes common sense because now you're not retraining people. They like it there, you know?
Right. There are so many business benefits to reducing turnover. And I've seen examples even in recent years, as challenging as healthcare has been, when leaders lead differently and change the culture and support the people doing the work and focus on safety and quality. And, you know, this is in a home healthcare division of a large health system. They, within a year, cut their turnover rate from roughly 75% to something like 15%.
Wow. And that's unbelievable.
The cost of hiring, retraining, ramping people up. I mean, turnover has huge costs. And, you know, I think it's sad when leaders are dismissive of, like, well, oh, you know, my employees, they're all interchangeable cogs. If they leave, we'll hire new ones. And, like, well, I think you want to engender loyalty to the business and, you know, to a point that stability and longevity and alignment around the success of the company, you know, is really powerful. And there's a lot of data out there that shows, I mean, psychological safety, the reason to do it isn't to be nice. It's good for business.
Yeah.
Right. It goes hand in hand. I think it's a better, fairer way to treat people that leads to undeniable business benefits.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. All right. So, we mentioned it at the beginning, and I want you to talk a little bit more about when we were talking about lean hospitals, because that was, when did you write that book?
So the first edition came out in 2008, and it's okay. It's now in a third edition, which I think was 2016. So yeah, kind of updated and revised now to the third edition. That's the one mostly available now.
And I just want to know, curiosity.
Yeah.
How, like, why? Like, what was it that you saw that you said, all right, I got to put this down for people to use?
Well, so, I mean, there's a couple of things that led up to that. So, you know, I'm an industrial engineer with an MBA. I started my career focused on manufacturing. I worked at General Motors, Dell Computer, a software startup, Honeywell, big, you know, global.
That's completely different.
Manufacturing company. So you think, well, how did I end up working in healthcare? So, you know, there are things that I learned and was able to practice along the way, starting in the auto industry, where people might point to Toyota and refer to the Toyota production system as a different way of managing, a different culture. It leads to better employee engagement, better quality, better results. All the other automakers have been pretty fervently trying to copy and emulate Toyota over the past 30 years. But then, you know, more broadly. Yeah. And more broadly, we might call that, if we don't want to call it Toyota production system, there was a phrase that was coined. I don't love the term, but you know, it was dubbed lean manufacturing. And so then we can generalize that as lean management. But you know, you can apply these principles and methods in healthcare or basically any type of business, because it's you know, it's a leadership style. It's a methodology for continuous improvement. It's really looking at how do we structure work? How do teams and different departments interact with each other? How does the work flow to the customer, whether that work is a car or a piece of software or a laboratory test that comes from a tube of blood, you know, that's taken from a patient? Even though, to state the obvious, you know, a car factory is different than a hospital, and cars are different than patients. These same concepts and principles for you know, designing work, improving work, managing work is very transferable. So I wasn't the first to do that in healthcare by any means. But when I had an opportunity in 2005 to join Johnson & Johnson, they had a consulting group that worked with hospitals and healthcare organizations. So that was my foot in the door. And then, you know, I was doing that work for a couple of years. And then I had been blogging, which was kind of my practice writing in a way. I've always kind of considered myself a writer. And a couple, you know, in 2008, I got introduced to somebody at a publisher who was looking for somebody to write an introductory book on quote unquote lean hospitals. So that's a different path than a lot of authors take, where they write the book and then try to find a publisher, or they have a pitch.
So I got
introduced to that publisher. I still had to write the proposal. I still had to go through their process, but that turned out to be my first book.
And I mean, I'm watching you here telling me your journey, and it makes sense, but it seems so different because I'm like, wait a minute. Like, that's over here. And then you're with Johnson & Johnson. And now to me, it looks like you've taken a full turn in general. I could be wrong on the mistakes that make us. And it's not just specifically those two.
No, that's totally right. I mean, you know, I'd written a couple of books that were very focused on, you know, healthcare leadership, healthcare improvement. My last two books were very intentionally written just more broadly as management books, you know, for a number of reasons. So, you know, The Mistakes That Make Us has examples from healthcare organizations, from software companies, manufacturing companies, services companies, because, you know, it kind of, you know, you boil down the key things. It comes down to people, the way leaders are behaving, some of the mindsets and the principles that we share. Like those are the things that are powerful and transferable, I would say. And then, you know, the other dimension of it, you know, my book Lean Hospitals has been translated into, I think, 8 different languages. So I've been able to travel, and I've been in countries including China and Brazil and Thailand. And to see my book translated into their language is...
That's cool.
Kind of mind-blowing. Then I have no idea of knowing whether the translation is good or not, because I don't speak those languages.
Oh my God. All right, so.
But these ideas are transferable. It's not about... Absolutely. American healthcare or Canadian healthcare, no translation required. Well, yeah. It could be a French, could be a Quebec French version, maybe. But like, you know, the way healthcare operates at the point of patient care tends to be pretty similar around different countries, even though the way we pay for healthcare obviously is very different. Like, what I'm looking at is what you might call healthcare delivery. How is that tube of blood drawn from your arm and taken to the lab and run through the equipment that gives a test result that ends up as information that your doctor and you can see? Like, what's the process around prepping for a surgery, doing a surgery, recovering the patient, sending the surgical instruments back to be cleaned and sterilized and repackaged? Like, that's all operations. It's not manufacturing, but it's operations.
All right. So where did you enjoy the most? Where did you like, wow, they have their system down? Anywhere? Any country?
In terms of healthcare organizations?
Yeah.
It's a great question.
Or not down, but like, okay, they got it going on.
Well, I mean, I think the exciting thing is seeing like when there's really dramatic improvement. Because I mean, I think a lot of times people will aim for, you know, 2 or 3% improvement. You know, you maybe kind of nibble around the edges of how the work is done, and okay, you might get 2 or 3% improvement. But when you really dig into the detail of how the work is done, and you start identifying, you know, if you will, systemic causes of waste. Like, this is not what's wrong with the workers, but this is like the physical layout of departments, The flow, the size of carts that are used. And I think of a couple examples. One is, you know, some work that I was involved in, in a big East Coast hospital. It was taking so long for the instruments to get from the operating rooms upstairs to the department in the basement that would clean, sort, sterilize, repackage those instruments. So surgeries were being delayed or canceled. That's bad for the patients. The surgeons get upset. When you talk about turnover and the risk of surgeons wanting to leave and go do procedures someplace else, it was really, bad situation. And this is not about telling people to work faster. It's about taking out the delays.
I
think of two examples. There's a funny parallel. So if the time, I'm trying to remember the exact hour, exact times, but we were able to go and reduce that amount of time that it took to come downstairs and come back upstairs by something like 75%. Not by working faster, but by like using smaller carts. Like, so if you have a cart and instrument trays are accumulating, you tend to not move the cart downstairs until the cart is full. I call this is like the airport rental car shuttle bus problem. Like, you're the first one on the shuttle bus, and then you sit there for 20 minutes because they seem hell-bent on not pulling away until it's full, right?
Yeah.
You know, think, well, it might be wasteful, and maybe they need smaller buses that run more frequently.
Yeah.
That might be, it's a business decision to make. But looking at things like delays of why is it taking so long to get to the basement and reducing what we call some of the batching. Right. And just rearranging where some of the tables and where some of the equipment is so that people can hand off their work more readily to the next person instead of piling it on a cart and then moving the cart when it's full. And, you know, you see dramatic reductions in that flow time. And now instruments are getting back up to the OR. The quality ends up being better as well because we're making different process improvements that help prevent the mistake of leaving an instrument out of the tray, improvements like this are supposed to be better for the people doing the work. You're making the work easier and less frustrating and less taxing, better for the patients, better for the surgeons, better for the financial performance of the hospital. Then the other example I can think of is a public library in suburban Dallas. Now, this is not work I did, but I've been able to go visit and meet the people at this hospital or this library that we're doing this work. And one of their key factors is like when they have popular books and Sandy returns the book and I'm waiting for it, it might have taken 2 days to get back on the shelf because big carts, delays. And so they did some process improvements. And one of the improvements literally was as simple as smaller carts. So now there's less delay of getting the book out to the shelf. There's less safety risk and ergonomic risk of pushing a heavy cart of books across a carpeted floor. And then the library patrons get notified more quickly. Hey, that book's available now. Come in and get it. There's employee satisfaction, employee safety, customer satisfaction. And guess what? The library doesn't need to own as many copies of a particular book, right? It's meant to all go hand in hand instead of like, well, let's make things better for the customers at the expense of the workers. No, we want benefits for everybody involved. And a lot of it comes down to rethinking the way we do the work, challenging some assumptions. Like when people say, well, that's the way it's always been. Sometimes there's gold hiding behind that statement, you know?
You know, it's blowing my mind that, let's go with the hospital car in the basement first, how one very easy thing to correct made such a massive difference.
Yeah.
The size of the freaking car.
Yeah.
Like, and so many times I think it's something right in front of our face that seems like, well, how did you not see it? But we don't see it. And then, somebody like you comes in and you're like, well, just, and you're like, duh. Well, and it's a It affects so many people, that one thing.
Yeah. Well, and it ends up being many things. You know, I'm kind of oversimplifying the story a bit, but the size of the cart and the delay.
Yeah, but that, even that one thing. I'm sure factor. Other things, but even just right. that one thing
right.
made a huge but, difference.
But when you say, yeah, then I've learned to be careful about when people have those, oh, duh moments. Like you need to try to uncover these opportunities in a way that doesn't make people feel bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm not saying, well, duh, you know, and I'm not trying to shame them of what's wrong with you for not having figured this out. But the one thing I've learned that works really, really well, it's not me coming in and pointing out the exact thing that needs to be changed, but I can teach them certain principles and concepts. I can teach them how to study the work and they'll find these things 99 times out of 100, but okay. they haven't been given the luxury of time and some
taking the methodology. Time to think about it. Yeah.
Like when you're so busy doing the work,
yep.
it's hard to think about improving the work because you're just getting through the day or you're doing it. You're kind of on autopilot and doing it the way you've always done it. But you know, I think the key thing with some of these lean improvement projects, it's me and sometimes some other facilitators. We're working with a team of the frontline staff. And then they might feel a little bad that they didn't discover these things earlier, but they generally come around to feeling really good that they did figure it
yeah,
out.
Yeah, the way well,
and
that's the way you
it's
said
their
it.
It's their improvements, not my improvements.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they're the ones that have to live with it and stay there.
That's wonderful. That you come in and do that. Not everybody does.
Yeah.
The way you're handling it, this is a team effort. You make them feel like they're part of it, you know, which is so different than
yeah.
I was reading some stuff. You said that, look, it's obvious. It's right here. You're right. Cause then you do feel like, duh, you make them not feel that way.
Right.
Which right. is amazing. Then, yeah. then plus they're more excited to implement it. They're so happy.
Yes. And then, the mindset in that team is, okay, well, we've got these new ideas. We're going to do it this new way. We're all invested in making it work, right? Yeah. So even when you design a new process that you're pretty certain is better than the old process, there's still going to be little mistakes you made, things you didn't quite realize, little hiccups.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you're telling people to implement my solution, they might not feel that strongly about it. They might be like, yeah, they're indifferent. And then they try it this new way and then they hit hiccups and they're like, oh, see, it doesn't work.
Absolutely.
You want them to be invested in doing the ongoing refinement of that process because it's their new process and it's partially for their benefit. And they, of course, in this case, they care about the benefit to the surgeons and to the patients.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
So you're not, you know, trying to force... Instead of trying to force change on people, it's a matter of engaging them. And this is not manipulating people to see it my way. It's got to be authentically, you know, a process of working together and discovering it together. And, you know, I play a role as a facilitator of, you know, trying to help them challenge the status quo or formulate how do we present this to your management in a way that might be better received. You know, I do play a role, but it's not a matter of me finding all the problems and having all the answers.
Yeah. And I like that you said that. I was thinking about that at a hospital, especially. You don't have the luxury sometimes to take a step back and work on, you know, resolving some issues. You just got to keep going. The patients keep coming and you coming in and then them forming the team to do this. I mean, good for them for bringing you in too.
Yeah. Well, and then there's another thing, and this comes back to management or executives. Another example of the way we've always done it, you know, healthcare has this habit of, you know, if work has gotten slow at the end of the shift, they'll send people home early. They'll say, well, we're saving money. Well, and now that nurse who thought they were going to get paid for a 12-hour shift is only getting paid for 9.5. They still commuted the same. And, you know, they might be tired and ready to go home, but, you know, you're kind of messing with people's pay and they'll say, well, we have to send people home. I'm like, I show me the law. I don't think there's a state or federal law that says you have to send nurses home when the patient volumes are down. You have a choice. You could use that time to, you know, do improvement. You have choices. You can, and this is not, you know, sitting around drinking coffee, but like, I think when you have motivation, which is strong in healthcare, when you have psychological safety and encouragement and alignment of, hey, if we improve, we're all going to benefit, people will gladly take 2 hours to work on different improvement opportunities that, well, we didn't have time yet, but now we've got this 2 hour window. Instead of going home early, we're going to invest in our future performance by spending a couple hours working on improvement. That's a choice that you could make, just the same as the choice to send people home. Like, are we going to save money today or invest a little bit in saving more money in the future?
Everybody wins. All right. I got to get this in, Mark, or I'm going to be in big trouble with my people because they want to know, since you have the podcasts, what's one of the biggest mistakes you've learned from? Because he asked all his guests that.
Right. Oh, I've made a lot of different podcasting mistakes. One mistake I've made that I've never repeated, and this probably happened, I've been podcasting since 2006. I think this was a mistake I made in about 2010. I forgot to hit record.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
Yeah.
And now we talk about themes from the podcast and the book. And I admitted it. It wasn't a $10,000 tax mistake. I could have blamed some sort of technical glitch or issue or hard drive crash. It wasn't like, Zoom makes it very clear and obvious to me that you're recording. And if I didn't see that little red recording dot, I might say, hey, Sandy, are we really recording? But back then I was recording through Skype and we had no visual this way. And the person on the other end didn't necessarily know I was recording. So I owned up to it. I said, I forgot to hit record. I feel really bad about that. I feel like I wasted 30 minutes of your time. And that person couldn't have been any more gracious. And the reaction was, well, let's call that a practice session. We'll do it again someday and it'll be better than we did that first time. And I thought, well, that was great. Like, that's one of my lessons.
Oh, that was a reward. That was a reward.
Yeah. But now one time as a guest, and this happened in the last 2 years, I was on the opposite end of that kind of glitch. And I didn't see it recording in Zoom, but sometimes people have a system that things are running through that's recording it. And so I didn't speak up. In hindsight, I should have. Hey, I don't see the recording thing. And they would have said, oh, it's running through the, and they might have noticed, oh crap, it wasn't. Because then they came back to me and they kind of, I think they forgot to hit record. They sort of framed it more as, a technical glitch. But I had to repay it back. I reacted the exact same way. I'm like, hey, no worries. These things happen. I've done that before. We'll do it again. And we did, right? I wasn't going to waste time being upset or bent out of shape about it. So that's one mistake. And I think the other mistake, more generally, I always, with guests, especially if they came through a PR firm, I would suggest, let's do a pre-call. Like, let's meet briefly. You and I did that before my favorite mistake. Partly just to make sure the person who's going to be a guest knows in advance, I'm going to ask them, what's your favorite mistake? And when that pre-call didn't happen, sometimes there were miscommunications or a lack of communication. And we start the episode and I ask that question and I could tell, oh God, this person has not been prepped. They don't have an answer. I'm putting them on the spot. And I realize, I could blame PR firms or I can take responsibility for the situation of not putting that person in a bad spot. So with rare exception, it's a pretty hard set rule now. You have to do the pre-call so that we can check in, get acquainted, but mainly for me to double check, this is not just show up and tell your usual three stories, that this is different. Because again, I think I want to be fair to the guests and not put them in a bad position. And, that's a mistake where I made some adjustments. I could have just blamed others, but I tried to take responsibility for what I could control to make that better.
Yeah. Works out. And you get to know them a little bit more. All right. What is a mistake, nothing to do with the podcast, that happened recently that you learned from in any part of life?
It's hard to pick one. I mean, one
Besides the water spilling.
Besides the water spilling. And I could blame the mug, but again, I need to take responsibility.
It could be professionally, like any area of business.
Yeah, I mean, this was a mistake related to a webinar. So it's kind of adjacent to podcasts. But, you know, I'm hosting and moderating webinars where people come on and present. And one of the things I'm supposed to do is, as the presentation starts, there's a chat box and I copy and paste a message that I prepared in advance. Like, hey, if you'd like to get the slides for note taking, here's the link. Copy, paste, hit send. So one of the things that I use as a tool to try to prevent mistakes is a checklist. I have a checklist of like, here's 20 things you need to make sure you do, including hit record.
Yeah.
You know, and one of those things is to put that message into the chat. So I could possibly forget to do that. That's not the mistake I made this time. The mistake I made was copying and pasting it. And then I sent and it went to host and presenter, host and panelist. I hadn't clicked the drop down to select everybody because I was trying to send it to all of the 100 people in the audience. And so then I discovered about 20 minutes in, because I replied to someone else's comment in the chat, and I'm like, oh gosh, I haven't been chatting to everybody. So I noticed my mistake. And the thing that was interesting is I had even said verbally to the audience, okay, well, I'm going to be putting a link to the slides in the chat. And nobody called me out. Like most of the time, 9 times out of 10, somebody would be speak up and I would be thankful of like, I don't see the link in the chat. And I would have figured that out, you know, but that was a very minor mistake. It's not a $10,000 mistake. It's not a spilling water all over yourself mistake. But my high level mistake was not using my checklist as diligently as I should have, because it's easy to get lulled into complacency of you do something right many times in a row and you think, well, I know what's in the checklist. I'm going to just go through it mentally. But then about 3 minutes before the start of the podcast, the panelists, and I'm not blaming them, I'm just stating fact, they had some sort of technical issue that we were now frantically trying to troubleshoot instead of calmly catching our breath and getting ready to go live with the webinar. That's a moment when the checklist should have bailed me out, is under that pressure, under that stress.
Good point. Yeah.
And yep. My mistake was not being disciplined about the checklist. And I hosted a webinar yesterday and I'd put a reminder on my calendar to myself, print out the checklist and use it. And I did. And I didn't repeat the mistake with copying and pasting.
Yeah.
The slides link into the chat. But I think more importantly, I need to maintain that habit. A checklist is only as good as your willingness to use it.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny because my son, now and then he'll commute back and forth to school. He lives there, but he can come back and forth and he likes to do his art here. But when he gets on the train, there's so many things to take back to school, right? I mean, it's like 7 things because he's got all this art stuff going on. And he would go out the door and half the time forget something. And I'm like, okay, we're making a checklist. Like, Mom, I'm like, you're making a checklist. So every time he's home, when he's out that door, we make the checklist. And inevitably, he would have forgot something.
Yeah.
So is it really not worth taking that moment? Versus you didn't have your keys, you didn't have your wallet, you didn't have your easel. It makes sense to me.
I mean, some people use a checklist to prepare for a trip. You're packing for a vacation. Checklists like this are a form of mistake proofing.
Yes.
Maybe not perfect, but better than not having a checklist.
Yeah, better than not.
If it's good enough for pilots, if pilots can use checklists, so can I.
That's true. They do. All right. So we're almost out of time, Mark. I'm so glad you came on the show. It was just awesome. And I'm thinking they can reach out to you. There's so many questions I had here for you, but we're not going to be able to get to them all. But tell us a little bit more about why you created the podcast before we go.
Yeah. So like I mentioned earlier, I started podcasting in 2006. That's a podcast about lean management. And that's still ongoing. But in 2020, summer of 2020, I wasn't able to travel as much for work because of the pandemic, and it's kind of looking for other things to do. And PR firms would pitch guests for my Lean podcast, which is so niche and so narrow, it was hard to fit other people in. But they, one PR firm proposed Kevin Harrington, who was one of the sharks on season one of Shark Tank. I thought, I really don't want to say no. Like, how do I find, I want to create a way to say yes, because I would like to meet him and talk to him. And this concept and ideas around learning from mistakes has been, you know, a big part of my life. So I kind of proposed that, like, do you think he would want to come on and talk about a mistake? I don't know, we can call it my favorite mistake, like the Sheryl Crow song. And he said yes to that. And he was great. He told a wonderful story. It's in the podcast. It's in the book about a mistake he made that almost put his business under. Ooh. And he didn't blame anybody. He took ownership for it. He talked about what did you learn? How did you improve? Like, he set such a good example. I hope I can find other guests who could be as forthright and good about things like you were, Sandy, and all my other guests. Like, you know, that's the short origin story. I think it's a fascinating question for the stories and reflections that it prompts. What's your favorite mistake?
Yeah, it is. All right, Mark, thank you so much for being on Let's Keep It Real. But before we go, tell us how we can find you, how we can watch your podcast, and how they can purchase your books.
Yeah, well, thank you. So people can go to markgraban.com, G-R-A-B-A-N, markgraban.com, or then go to mistakesbook.com or mistakespodcast.com. Those are probably the easiest ways to find me online. So I'm sorry that my water spill and I got long-winded. I'm sorry we didn't get through all the questions, but this has been a lot of fun.
No, it's good that we didn't get through all the questions. That means, you know, this is a hot topic for people, you know?
Yeah.
And you're not long-winded. And I'm happy the water spilled.
So am I.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see the clip of that. I will certainly help share that, not just the whole episode.
My favorite thing that you said, you'll wait till you see.
I hope I didn't curse.
No, you said, I just made a big mistake. The beginning of the show. I'm like, okay, well, I couldn't plan that.
Nope.
All right, well, let's keep it real, people. Mark and I would really appreciate you sharing, liking, and rating it. And you know what I'm going to say? Until next time. Toodles.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to share and subscribe if you enjoyed the show. And remember, keep spreading the positive.